In her capacity as counselor to the president, Karen initially had purview over four offices and later added a fifth, global communications. The communications office was responsible for strategic communications planning, looking a week to 2 weeks down the road, and for execution of the overall strategy. It was the central office for coordinating Bush's message throughout the White House and the administration. And it was the office responsible for making sure that the picture of the day reinforced the message and image of Bush that we sought to portray. I'm referring here to a literal picture, which was carefully planned in the hopes that it would end up above the fold in the next day's newspapers or prominently featured on the evening news. From a simple picture of Bush greeting soldiers, if the day's theme was military preparedness, to the elaborately choreographed scene of Bush speaking in front of the Statue of Liberty on the anniversary of 9/11. Reagan's team had perfected this art of stagecraft, and the man in charge for Bush, Deputy Communications Director Scott Sforza, took it to new heights. The Office of the Press Secretary was a round-the-clock operation that focused on the National and White House Press Corps and handled daily media relations with them, conducting daily briefings and being the chief spokesman for the White House. There was close coordination with other communicators, but the press secretary had plenty of autonomy to run the office as he saw fit. When I became press secretary, the role was to faithfully articulate the president's views, decisions, and policies, and publicly advocate for and defend them with the national media. The Office of Media Affairs focused on local media across the United States and daily media relations. The media affairs team responded to inquiries from the local media outlets, helped coordinate with those outlets when the president traveled to their respective areas, and was responsible for coordinating presidential interviews with local reporters. The Office of Speechwriting was responsible for churning out countless presidential speeches and remarks. The speechwriting process played a vital role in driving policy. Drafts of speeches would be circulated to all relevant White House offices, including the president's senior advisors and specific policy advisors. The president had the final say, but if an advisor wanted to influence policy, the speechwriting process was one way to do so. In addition to her abilities as a communicator, Karen had a strong force of personality and a keen understanding of the more traditional political views of middle America, as well as where the broad majority in the center usually comes down on an issue. Both attributes benefited Bush greatly. Karen had her own assertive and imposing presence within the White House. She was not afraid to assert her views in meetings or go directly to the president privately. She also had a good grasp of how to connect with everyday Americans and help the president better communicate his policies and decisions and set the right tone with them. Just as important, Karen provided a good counterbalance to Karl Rove. He had strong beliefs about the way things should be done. So did Karen. While Karl's views were oriented largely around the conservative base, Karen's focused on everyday Americans toward the center of the political spectrum. The differences were less over policy than over tone, message, policy framing, and public emphasis. The two worked well together, but were not shy about disagreeing openly in front of the president. It was what one would expect from two strong-willed, opinionated, and knowledgeable individuals who both had the full and extraordinary confidence of the president. The third member of the White House troika was Andy Card, a tireless public servant who brought years of experience to his position as chief of staff. His sphere of influence was built on both his position and his closeness to the president. Though he was more of a facilitator for the president, noticeably less domineering and softer spoken than either Carl or Karen. His role was to serve as an honest broker among the staff inside the White House and help make sure all views were heard, while privately offering his views to the president as needed and appropriate, usually once the policy process had time to work its course. Andy understood how Washington and the White House operate, since he had served both Reagan and the president's father. He also understood the unparalleled trust Bush placed in Rove and Hughes and how much he valued their viewpoints. Andy worked to make sure the policy processes ran their full course and that staffers felt included in them. He managed the president's most valued commodity, his time, in part by making sure that people saw the president only when they really needed to. Most notably, Andy managed and oversaw the White House exactly the way Bush preferred, firmly, with discipline, focus, and thoughtful, deliberate planning. When Bush required it, Andy kept the administration compartmentalized in a way that restricted information to a select few. I first met Andy on the campaign trail back in 2000. My recollection is that it was ahead of the Republican convention, which he had been tapped to oversee. He came across as a very likable person, courteous and dignified, but I did not really get to know him until we worked together in the White House. Toward the end of the transition, just ahead of the inaugural, Andy assembled all of the staffers who would be working in the West Wing. Most, like me, had never worked in the White House before. We listened intently as he talked about what we should expect and what he expected of us. He talked about the honor of working there. He stressed the importance of working together as a team. We were all there to serve the president. He talked about the importance of humility, not letting our jobs go to our head. He talked about the intensity of working there. And he let us know that the average tenure of someone who works in the West Wing is about 2 years. He told us to remember to know when it is time to leave. He cited the example of John Sununu, chief of staff to the first President Bush, who had failed to recognize when it was time to go until it was forced upon him. It was hard to appreciate what he was saying then, but after serving in the White House, I understood his remarks much better. One could become too comfortable inside the bubble. When that happens, one's perspective becomes stale and one's energy is drained. Burnout can set in. A president needs change, fresh perspectives, and new energy from his staff. That's why turnover is important and, when correctly timed, a very beneficial process. Of course, Roe, Views, and Card weren't the only powerful figures in the Bush White House. Two other prominent advisors at the beginning were the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, and the Vice President, Dick Cheney. Rice, who mentored Bush on foreign policy, was the person whose advice the president relied on most when it came to national security issues starting during the presidential campaign. Lacking a deep background in foreign policy, Bush counted on a team of foreign policy heavyweights with diverse expertise to help him formulate policy based on his guiding principles, such as freedom, a strong military, and free trade. Rice headed the group, referred to as the Vulcans. It included Richard Armitage, Colin Powell's alter ego, Paul Wolfowitz and Steve Hadley, two proteges of Dick Cheney, Richard Pearl, Bob Blackwell, Bob Zelick, a James Baker protege, and Dov Zakheim. George Shultz was often called on for advice, and once Dick Cheney became the vice presidential nominee, he too was directly involved. The name of the group was based on the imposing statue of Vulcan, the Roman god of fire and metalworking that is a landmark in Rice's hometown of Birmingham, Alabama. Bush developed a strong personal bond with Rice and came to trust her judgment, instincts, and insights. As Hughes and Bush's style and tone of communicating were one and the same, so too were Rice's and Bush's views on foreign policy. From the beginning, the president wanted the vice president and his staff included in his White House processes and operations. Dick Cheney and his key advisors were considered integral members of the team. Bush valued Cheney's experience and knowledge, particularly on national security matters, and sought his counsel. At the same time, Cheney and his advisors essentially ran their own operation, as I will discuss later in this book. Bush and Cheney's relationship was close and substantially private. Cheney tended to offer his counsel in private to the president. He or his top advisors were included in all presidential policy briefings, world leader meetings, congressional meetings, and the like. Of course, Cheney heavily influenced foreign policy. He also took particular interest in economic policy, especially tax and energy issues. Bush showed Cheney great deference, especially when he designated him to take on a specific task, such as heading the Energy Task Force early in the administration, or bird-dogging buy-in from congressional leaders on the controversial warrantless wiretapping program instituted after 9/11. Bush also relied on Cheney's ability to shape what Bush considered vital national security policies on matters such as al-Qaeda detainees. But it was the troika of Rove, Hughes, and Card, especially Rove, who drove the permanent campaign inside the Bush White House, embracing and emulating the manipulative political and communication tactics used by Bush's predecessor that had put off many Americans. It was all done through carefully orchestrated campaigns to shape sources of public approval to Bush's advantage, such as the ones developed to advance tax cuts, education reform, and the selling of the war in Iraq. At least in the early days of the presidency, the troika and the structure of the White House served Bush well. While Cheney declared in early 2001 that the days of the war room and the permanent campaign are over, the reality was far from it. The permanent campaign was simply being restructured, redefined, and expanded to how it best suited the Bush White House. Permanent campaign-style methods proved highly successful as the early Bush White House sold two high-priority agenda items to the public and got them passed in Congress. These early successes may have contributed to the air of invincibility that set in, leaving the administration vulnerable to the mistakes that later damaged the Bush presidency.